Side 3, Cradle, by Arthur C. Clarke and Gentry Lee. Continuing on page 58. Carol swam carefully down to the floor of the trench, skillfully avoiding contact with the edges of the reef on both sides. Where it disappeared under the overhang, the trench was just wide enough for her to put one of her flippered feet down lengthwise. The overhang was about 18 inches above the floor. But there was no way she could bend down and look underneath without scraping her face or hands against the reef. Carol gingerly slid her hand under the overhang in the last direction of the tracks. Nothing. She would have to brace herself against the rocks and coral and stick her hand deeper into the area. While Carol was trying to move herself into a better position, she momentarily lost her balance and felt the sting of coral on the back of her left thigh. Ouch, she thought as she put her right hand back under the overhang. That's one for me. One physical reminder of an amazing day. Weird, even. Bizarre whales. Tank tracks on the bottom of the ocean. What is this? Carol's hand closed around what felt like a metallic rod about an inch thick. It was such a surprising touch, she immediately withdrew her hand, and a shudder raced down her spine. Her heart rate accelerated, and she tried to breathe slowly to calm herself. Then she purposefully put her hand back and found the object again. Or was it another object? This time she felt something metallic, all right, but it seemed to be wider and to have four tines like a fork. Carol slid her hand along the object and refound the rod portion. From his vantage point above her, Nick could tell that Carol had discovered something. Now it was his turn to be excited. He swam down to her as she struggled unsuccessfully to retrieve the object. They changed positions, and Nick reached under the projecting rock. He first touched something that felt like a smooth sphere about the size of the palm of his hand. Nick could tell that the bottom of the sphere rested on the sand, and that the rod attached to it was elevated by several inches. Nick steadied himself and jerked on the rod. It moved a little. He moved his grip sideways on the rod and heaved again. Several more pulls, and the object was out from under the overhang. For almost a minute, Nick and Carol hovered over the gold metallic object lying beneath them on the sand. Its surface was smooth to the eye as well as to the touch, and altogether it was about 18 inches long. Nothing but the polished, reflecting surface could be seen, suggesting that the object was indeed made from some kind of metal. The long axis of the object was an inch-thick rod that was, at one end, tapered and worked into a kind of a hook. 4 inches back from the hook was the center of a small sphere, symmetrically constructed around the rod, whose radius was a little over 2 inches. The larger sphere that Nick had felt when he first put his hand under the overhang had a radius of 4 inches or so, and it was right in the middle of the rod. This sphere was also perfectly symmetric around the rod axis. Beyond the two spheres, the object was unadorned until the rod broke into 4 smaller branches, the tines that Carol had felt, at its other end. Carol carefully took photographs of the object as it lay exposed in front of the overhang. Before she was finished, Nick pointed at his watch. They had been underwater almost an hour. Carol checked her air gauge and found that she was almost into the red. She waved a sign at Nick, and he swam down to pick up the object. It was extremely heavy, weighing an astonishing 20 pounds or so in Nick's estimation. Then it wasn't caught on anything when I was trying to pull it out, Nick thought. It's just that heavy. The weight of the object only increased Nick's excitement that had begun when he had first seen the gold color. Although he had never seen anything quite like this hook and fork with spheres, he remembered that the heaviest pieces from the wreck of the Santa Rosa had all been made of gold, and this piece was far heavier than anything he had ever touched. Jesus, he thought to himself as he discarded some of the lead weights in his belt to make it easier for him to carry the object up to the boat. If there's even 10 pounds of pure gold here, at current market value of $1,000 an ounce, that's $160,000, and this may just be the beginning. Wherever this thing came from, there must be more. All right, Williams, this may be your lucky day. Carol's thoughts raced at a mile a minute as she swam in tandem with Nick toward the anchor rope. She was busy trying to integrate everything she had seen in the last hour. She was already convinced that everything was somehow associated with the errant Navy missile, the behavior of the whales, the golden fork with the hook, the tank tracks on the bottom of the ocean. But at first, Carol had no clue about what the connections were. During the swim back, Carol suddenly remembered reading some years before a story about Russian submarine tracks being found on the ocean floor outside a Swedish naval yard. In her journalistic mind, she began to concoct a wild but plausible scenario to explain everything that she had seen. Maybe the missile crashed near here and continued to send out data even when it was underwater, she thought to herself. Its electronic signals somehow confused the whales. And maybe those same signals were picked up by Russian submarines. And American. Her thoughts came to a temporary dead end for a moment. So there are at least two choices, Carol thought again after swimming a few more strokes and watching Nick approach the anchor rope with the golden object still firmly in his hand. Either I've found a Russian plot to locate and steal an American missile, or the tracks and golden fork are somehow part of an American effort to find the missile without alerting the public. It doesn't matter. Either way, it's a big story. But I must take that golden thing to Dale and MOI to analyze. Both Nick and Carol were dangerously low on air by the time they reached the surface beside the Florida Queen. They called Troy to give them a hand with their prize from the deep. Carol and Nick were exhausted when they finally crawled into the boat. But they were also both on emotional highs, thrilled with the discoveries of the afternoon. Everyone started talking at once. Troy had a story to tell, too, for he had seen something unusual on the monitor while Nick and Carol were following the tracks in the trench. Nick pulled some beer and sandwiches out of the refrigerator and Carol tended her coral cuts. The laughing trio sat down on the deck chairs together as the sun was setting. They had much to share during the 90-minute trip back to Key West. 8. The camaraderie lasted most of the way back to the marina. Nick was no longer taciturn. Excited by what he believed was the initial find of a major sunken treasure, he was positively a chatterbox. At least twice, he retold his version of the whale encounter. Nick was certain that the collision was accidental, that the whale simply happened to be moving in that direction for some other reason and just paid no attention to the fact that Nick was there. Impossible, Nick had scoffed when Carol had initially suggested that the whale might have deliberately hit him because he was heading for the fissure in the reef. Whoever heard of whales guarding a spot in the ocean? Besides, if your theory's right, then why didn't the whale really smack me and finish me off? You're asking me to accept that the whales were protecting an underground cave? And then that they were warning me to stay away with that gentle push? He laughed good-naturedly. Let me ask you something, Miss Dawson, he said. Do you believe in elves and fairies? From where I was watching, Carol replied, it sure looked as if the whole thing was planned. She did not pursue the subject further. In fact, after her initial outbursts, Carol did not talk very much about anything on the trip back to Key West. She too was excited, and she was worried that if she talked too much, she might inadvertently give away her thoughts about the possible connection between what they had seen and the lost Navy missile. So she didn't mention either her eerie fear just before the whale hit Nick or the network of tracks she thought she saw converging just under the base of the fissure. As far as Nick was concerned, the object they had retrieved was definitely part of a treasure. It didn't bother him that it was hidden under an overhang at the end of some strange tracks. He shrugged it off by suggesting that maybe somebody had found the sunken treasure several years earlier and then tried to hide a few of the better pieces. But why were the tracks fresh, and what had made them? Carol wanted to ask these questions, but realized it was in her best interest for Nick to remain convinced that he had found treasure. Nick was blind to all arguments and even facts that didn't support his treasure theory. It was emotionally vital to Nick for the gold fork thing to be the first piece of a great discovery. And, like many people, Nick was capable of suspending his normally sharp critical faculties when he had a vested emotional involvement in an issue. When Nick and Carol finally quieted down enough to listen, Troy had a chance to tell his own story. After you guys left the area underneath the boat, I guessed to follow your trench, I became worried about you and started watching the screen more often. Now, Angel, by this time, those three whales had been swimming about in that same dumb pattern for over an hour, so I wasn't checking them real close. Troy was up out of his deck chair, walking back and forth in front of Carol and Nick. It was a dark night. Low clouds had rolled in from the north to block the moon and obscure most of the stars. The spotlight from the top of the canopy occasionally caught Troy's chiseled features as he moved in and out of the shadows. "Because I wanted to find you guys, I lifted the alarm suppression the way you showed me and was regularly serenaded by the ding-dong-ding from the three whales. Now listen to this. After a couple of minutes, I heard a fourth alarm. I looked down at the monitor expecting to see one of you, and I saw another whale, same species, swimming underneath the other three and in the opposite direction. Within 10 seconds, the original whales turned, breaking their long pattern, and followed the new whale off the monitor to the left. They never returned." Troy wound up the story with a dramatic inflection, and Nick laughed out loud. "Jesus, Jefferson, you do have a way of telling a story. I suppose you're going to tell me now that these whales were stationed there, and the new guy came along with different orders, or something like that. Christ, between you and Carol, you'll have me believe that the whales are organized into covens or whatever." Nick stopped for a moment. Troy was disappointed that Carol didn't say anything. "Now," Nick continued, dismissing Troy's story and getting to the subject he had been thinking about for almost an hour, "we have an important issue to discuss. We have brought back something from the ocean that could conceivably be worth a lot of money. If nobody else can prove conclusively that it is theirs, then it will belong to the finders." Nick looked first at Carol and then at Troy. "Even though I'm captain and owner of this boat, and I carried the thing up from the ocean floor, I'm prepared to offer that we split the proceeds in thirds. Does that sound fair enough to the two of you?" There was a moderately long silence before Troy answered. "Sure, Nick, that sounds fine to me." Nick smiled and reached across to shake Troy's hand. He then extended his hand to Carol. "Just a minute," she said quietly, looking directly at Nick and not taking his hand. "Since you've decided to start this conversation, there are several more items that must be discussed. It's not simply a question of money for this object. There's also the issue of possession. Who keeps the golden trident? Who determines when we've been offered a fair price? What do we agree to say or not to say to others? And what if other objects are found down there by one or more of us? Do we all share? There's an entire agreement that must be worked out before we dock." Nick frowned. "Now I understand why you've been so quiet these last few minutes. You've been thinking about your share. I misjudged you. I thought you might decide not to create any more trouble." "Who said anything about trouble?" Carol interrupted him abruptly, her voice rising slightly. "If you must know, I'm not that interested in the damn money. I will gladly take my 1/3 if any dollars are forthcoming from the trident there, for I certainly deserve it. But if any more such treasures are down there, and you and Troy can find them without me, then be my guest. I want something else." Both men were now listening intently. "First and foremost, I want exclusive rights to the story, and that means absolute secrecy about what we have found, when and where we found it, and anything else associated with it. At least until we're certain there's nothing more to learn. Second, I want immediate possession of the object for 48 hours, before anyone else knows that it exists. After that, you can have it to take to the authorities for evaluation." "Uh-oh," Carol thought to herself as she saw the searching looks she had elicited from Nick and Troy. "I overdid it. They suspect something. Better back off just a bit." "Of course," she smiled disarmingly. "I've just given my initial position. I expect that some negotiations may be necessary."
"Wow, Angel," Troy said with a laugh. "That was some speech. For just a minute there, I thought that maybe there was a whole other game going on here, and you were the only one playing. Of course, the professor and I will be delighted to discuss an agreement with you, won't we, Nick?"
Nick nodded. But he had also been alerted by the careful organization and unmistakable intensity of Carol's response. It seemed out of proportion to the journalistic value of their find. "Is she trying to make this some kind of a contest between us?" he thought to himself. "Or am I missing something altogether?"
They had worked out a compromise agreement by the time the Florida Queen reached the dock in Key West. Nick would take the Golden Trident, both of the men liked Carol's name for the object, with him on Friday morning. There was an elderly woman in Key West who was a compendium of treasure knowledge, and she would be able to assess its value and to give its probable place and date of origin. The woman would also be a witness to their find in case the Trident were ever misplaced. On Friday afternoon, the three of them would meet on the boat or in the marina parking lot at 4 o'clock. Nick would give the object to Carol, and she would keep it over the weekend. After she returned it to Nick on Monday morning, he would be responsible for its care and eventual sale. The three of them had joint ownership of the Trident, but Carol waived any interest in future discoveries. Carol wrote the terms of the simple agreement on the back of a restaurant menu from her purse. They all signed it, and she promised to bring copies back the next day. Troy was quiet and subdued while he was loading all Carol's equipment back into the footlocker. He lifted the locker onto the cart and then pulled the cart along the jetty. Carol walked beside him. It was about 9 o'clock and very quiet at the marina. The tall fluorescent lights created a strange reflection on the wooden jetties.
"Well, Angel," Troy said as Carol and he approached the marina headquarters, "it's been quite a day. I've really enjoyed your company."
He stopped and turned to look at her. Her black hair had dried unevenly and looked a bit disheveled, but her face was beautiful in the reflected light. Troy looked away, out at the water and the boats.
"You know, it's a shame sometimes the way life works. You meet somebody by chance, you strike up a friendship, and then poof, they're gone. It's all so transient."
Carol came over beside him and stretched to kiss his cheek. "And you know I like you, too," she said, lightening up the conversation with a grin and making certain that Troy understood what kind of a friendship they could have. "But cheer up. All is not lost. You'll see me tomorrow for a while, and then maybe when I return the golden thing on Monday." She hooked her arm through his as they momentarily walked back down the jetty, away from the loaded cart. "And who knows?" Carol laughed. "I'm down in the Keys from time to time. We could have a drink together, and you could tell me some more stories." They could just barely make out the spotlight above the canopy on the Florida Queen, some 100 yards in the distance. "I see your friend, the professor, is still at work. He's not strong on goodbyes, or any other area of manners as far as I can tell." She turned, switching locked arms, and they walked back to the loaded cart. They moved through the apparently deserted headquarters without speaking. When the footlocker had been replaced in the station wagon, Carol gave Troy a hug. "You're a good man, Troy Jefferson," she said. "I wish you well." Nick was almost ready to leave by the time Troy returned to the boat. He was packing a small exercise bag. "Looks innocent enough, doesn't it, Troy? Nobody will ever suspect that one of the great treasures of the ocean is in here." He paused a moment and changed the subject. "You put her safely in her car?" "Good." "She's a strange one, isn't she? All feisty and aggressive, but still pretty at the same time. I wonder what makes her tick." Nick zipped up the bag and walked around to the side of the canopy. "Just finish up with the diving gear tonight. Don't worry about the rest of the boat. We'll fix it up tomorrow. I'm going to go home and dream of riches."
"Speaking of riches, Professor," Troy said with a smile, "how about that $100 loan I asked you for on Tuesday? You never answered me and just said we'll see."
Nick walked deliberately over to Troy and stood right in front of him. He spoke very slowly.
"I should have made my Polonius speech to both of us when you asked me for a loan the first time. But here we are now, borrower and lender, and I don't like it. I will lend you $100, but, Mr. Troy Jefferson, this is positively the last time. Please don't ever ask me again. These loans for your so-called inventions are making it hard for me to work with you."
Troy was a little surprised by the unexpected harshness in Nick's tone, but he was also angered by the connotation of the last sentence.
"Are you suggesting," Troy said softly, suppressing his temper, "that I'm not telling the truth, that the money is not being spent on electronics? Or are you telling me that you don't believe an uneducated black man could possibly invent anything worth having?" Nick faced Troy again. Spare me your righteous racial indignation. This is not a question of prejudice or lies. It's money, pure and simple. My lending you money is fucking up our friendship.
Troy started to speak, but Nick waved him off.
Now, it's been a long day, and a fascinating one at that. I've said all I want to say on the subject of the loan, and I consider the issue finished.
Nick picked up his bag, said goodnight, and left the Florida Queen. Troy went behind the canopy to organize the diving gear. About 10 minutes later, just as he was finishing, he heard someone calling his name.
Troy?
Troy? Is that you?
An accented voice said. Troy leaned around the canopy and saw Greta standing on the jetty under the fluorescent light. Even though there was now a slight chill in the air, she was wearing her usual skimpy bikini that showed off her marvelous physique. Troy broke into a grand smile.
Well, well, if it isn't Superkraut, how the hell are you? I can see you're still taking care of that wondrous body.
Greta managed the beginnings of a smile.
Homer and Alan and I are having a small party tonight. We noticed that you were working late and thought that maybe you'd like to join us when you're done.
Just might do that, Troy said, nodding his head up and down. Just might do that.
9.
Oh, God, can't we stop now? Finally? Please let us. It's so quiet here now.
She was speaking to the stars and the sky. The old man's head slumped forward in the wheelchair as he drew his last breath. Hannah Jelks knelt beside him to see if he was indeed gone, and then, after kissing him on the crown of the head, she looked up again with a peaceful smile. The curtain fell and rose again in a few seconds. The cast assembled quickly on stage.
Okay, that's it for tonight. Good job.
The director, a man in his early 60s, gray hair thinning on the top, approached the stage with a bounce.
Great performance, Henrietta. Try to can that one for the opening tomorrow night. Just the right combination of strength and vulnerability.
Melvin Burton nimbly jumped up on the stage.
And you, Jesse, if you make Maxine any lustier, they'll close us down.
He spun around with a flourish and laughed along with two other people at the front of the theater.
Okay, gang, Melvin turned back to address the cast. Now go home and get lots of rest. It was better tonight. Looked good.
Oh, Commander, can you and Tiffany stay around for a moment after you change? I have a couple more pointers for you.
He jumped back down from the stage and walked back to the fourth row of the theater where his two associates were sitting. One was a woman, even older than Melvin, but with twinkling green eyes behind her granny glasses. She was wearing a bright print dress full of spring colors. The other person was a man about 40, with a studious face and a warm, open manner. Melvin fretted as he sat down beside them.
I worried when we picked Night of the Iguana that it might be too difficult for Key West. It's not as well known as Streetcar or a Glass Menagerie. And in some ways, the characters are just as foreign as those in Suddenly Last Summer. But it looks almost okay. If we can just fix the scenes between Shannon and Charlotte...
Are you sorry now you added the prologue? The woman asked.
Amanda Winchester was an institution in Key West. Among other things, she was the doyenne of the theatrical entrepreneurs in the revitalized city. She owned two of the new theaters near the marina and had been responsible for the formation of at least three different local repertory groups. She loved plays and theater people, and Melvin Burton was her favorite director.
No, I'm not, Amanda. It clearly adds to the play to get some kind of initial feeling for how frustrating it would be to lead a group of Baptist women on a tour of Mexico in the summer. And without the sex scene between Charlotte and Shannon in that small, stuffy hotel room, I'm not sure their affair is believable to the audience.
He paused a moment, reflecting. Houston did the same thing with the movie.
Right now, that sex scene doesn't play at all, the other man said. In fact, it's almost comical. The hugs they exchange are like the ones my brother gives his daughters.
Patience, Mark, Melvin answered.
Something has to be done, or we should take the prologue out altogether, Amanda agreed. Mark's right. The scene tonight was almost comical. Part of the problem is that Charlotte looks like a child in that scene.
She paused a moment before continuing.
You know, the girl has gorgeous long hair, and we have it stacked on top of her head to look prim and proper. Clearly, she wouldn't wear it down all day in the heat of a Mexican summer. But what if she took it down when she went to Shannon's room?
That's a great idea, Amanda. As I have often said, you would have made a fabulous director.
Melvin looked at Mark, and they exchanged a warm smile. Then the director settled back in his seat and started thinking about what he was going to tell his two cast members in a few moments. Melvin Burton was a happy man. He lived with his roommate of 15 years, Mark Adler, in a beach house on Sugarloaf Key, about 10 miles east of Key West. Melvin had directed plays on Broadway for almost a decade and had been associated with the theater in one capacity or another since the mid-50s. Always careful with his money, Melvin had managed to save an impressive amount by 1979. Worried about the impact of inflation on his savings, Melvin had sought advice from an accountant who was a friend of a close associate. It was almost love at first sight. Mark was 28 at the time, shy, lonely, unsure of himself in the maelstrom of New York City. Melvin's savoir-faire and theatrical panache opened Mark up to aspects of life that he had never known. As the stock market ratcheted upward in the mid-80s, Melvin watched his net worth near $1 million. But other factors in his life were not so bullish. The AIDS epidemic hit the theatrical community in New York with a vengeance, and both Melvin and Mark lost many of their lifelong friends. And Melvin's career seemed to have peaked. He was no longer in demand as one of the premier directors. One night on his way home from the theater, Mark was mugged by a group of teenagers. They beat him up, stole his watch and wallet, and left him bleeding in the street. As a saddened Melvin ministered to his friend's wounds, he made a major decision. They would leave New York. He would sell his stocks and convert his fortune to fixed income investments. They would buy a home where it was warm and safe, where they could relax and read and swim together. Maybe they would do some community theater work if it was available, but that was not the most important thing. What was important was that they share Melvin's remaining years. Melvin ran into Amanda Winchester one day while he and Mark were on vacation in Key West. They had worked together briefly on a project that had never panned out 20 years before. Amanda told him that she had just formed a local amateur repertory group to do two Tennessee Williams plays a year. Would he be interested in directing them? Melvin and Mark moved to Key West and started to build their house on Sugarloaf Key. Both of them thoroughly enjoyed their work with the Key West Players. The actors were everyday people, dedicated and earnest. Some had had a little acting experience, but for the most part, the secretaries, housewives, and retail clerks, plus officers and enlisted men from the U.S. Naval Air Station, were all novices with one thing in common. Each of them viewed his few days on the stage as his moment of glory, and he wanted to make the best of it. Commander Winters came out of the dressing room first. He was wearing his uniform. He had come right over to rehearsal from the base and looked a bit stiff and uncertain. He sat down in one of the theater chairs next to Amanda Winchester.
"I was really glad to see you back again," said Amanda, taking his hand. "I thought your goober last fall was just right."
Winters thanked her politely. Amanda changed the subject.
"So how are things out at the base? I read an article the other day in the Miami Herald about all the modern weapons the Navy has these days, pilotless submarines and vertical takeoff fighters and search and destroy torpedoes. There seems to be no limit to our ability to build more powerful and dangerous toys for war. Are you involved with all that?"
"Only in a limited way," Commander Winters answered pleasantly. Then, anticipating the discussion with the director, he leaned forward so that he could see Melvin and Mark as well as Amanda. "I apologize if I was a little flat tonight," he began. "We have a couple of big problems out at the base, and I may have been a bit distracted, but I'll be ready tomorrow."
"Oh, no," said Melvin, interrupting him. "That's not what I wanted to talk to you about. It's your first scene with Tiffany. Ah, here she comes. Let's go up on the stage." Tiffany Thomas was almost 17 years old and a junior at Key West High School. A Navy brat all her life, Tiffany had gone to 7 different schools in her 11 years since kindergarten. Her father was a non-commissioned officer who had been assigned to Key West about 3 months before.
She had been recommended to Melvin Burton by the high school drama teacher when it became apparent that Denise Wright simply could not play the role of Charlotte Goodall. "She hasn't done anything for me yet except rehearse," the teacher had said of Tiffany. "But she learns her lines quickly and has a quality, an intensity, I guess, that sets her apart from the others. And she's clearly been in plays before. I don't know if she can get ready in 3 weeks, but she's my first choice by far." Tiffany probably would not have been called beautiful by her Florida classmates. Her features were too much out of the ordinary to be properly appreciated by most high school boys. Her assets were olive eyes, quiet and brooding, light freckles on a pale complexion, long red eyelashes tinged with brown, and a magnificent head of thick auburn hair. Her carriage was proper and erect, not slumped like most teenagers, so she probably seemed aloof to her peers. "Striking," Amanda called her, accurately, when she first saw Tiffany. She was standing on the stage alone in her short-sleeved blouse and jeans as the two men approached. Her hair was pulled back in a ponytail the way her father liked it. Tiffany was very nervous. She was worried about what Mr. Burton was going to say to her. She had overheard the buyer, who was playing Hannah Jelks, say that Melvin might do away with the part of Charlotte altogether if the new girl can't hack it. "I have worked so hard for this part," Tiffany thought. "Oh, please, please don't let it be bad news." Tiffany was looking down at her feet when Melvin Burton and Commander Winters joined her on the stage. "Well, now," Melvin began, "let's get straight to the point. The first scene with you two in a hotel room is not working. In fact, it's a disaster. We must make some changes." Melvin saw that Tiffany was not looking at him. Gently, he put his hand under her chin and lifted it until her eyes met his. "You must look at me, child, for I'm trying to tell you some very important things." He noticed that her eyes were brimming with water, and his years of experience told him immediately what was wrong. He leaned forward and whispered so that nobody else could hear. "I said we would make some changes, not do away with the scene. Now get yourself together and listen up." Burton regained his director's voice and turned toward Winters. "In this scene, Commander, your character Shannon and young Miss Goodall engage in foreplay that leads to intercourse later that night. In the following scene, they are discovered in flagrante delicto by the confused Miss Fellows. And that establishes the desperate situation causing Shannon to run to Maxine and Fred at the Costa Verde. But our scene does not work right now because nobody watching it will recognize what you two are doing as foreplay. Now I can change the movement to make it easier. Putting Shannon already on the bed when he discovers Charlotte behind the door would be one way. And I can change Charlotte's clothing so that she looks less like a little girl. But there's one thing that I cannot do." Melvin stopped and looked back and forth from Tiffany to Winters. They were both staring blankly at him. "Come here. Come here, both of you," Melvin said, gesturing impatiently with his right hand. He dropped his voice again. He took Tiffany's hand with his left and Commander Winters with his right. "You two are lovers for one night in this play. It is essential that the audience believe this, or they will not understand completely why Shannon is at the end of his rope, like the iguana. Shannon is desperate because he was originally locked out of his church for giving in to the same lust." They were both listening, but Melvin's director's intuition told him he was still not reaching them. He had another idea. He took Tiffany's hand and put it into the commander's, closing his own hand over theirs for emphasis. "Look at each other for a moment." "That's right." He turned to Winters. "She's a beautiful young woman, isn't she, Commander?" Their eyes were in contact. "And he's a handsome man, isn't he, Tiffany? I want you to imagine that you have an uncontrollable desire to touch him, to kiss him, to be naked with him." Tiffany blushed. Winters fidgeted. Melvin was fairly certain that he saw a spark, albeit a fleeting one. "Now tomorrow night," he continued, looking at Tiffany and taking his hand off theirs, "I want you to capture that feeling when you're hiding in his room. I want it to explode out of you when he notices that you were there. And you, Commander," he looked back at the middle-aged naval officer, "you are torn between an overpowering passion to possess this young girl physically and the almost certain knowledge that it will be the final ruination of both your life and your soul. You are hopelessly trapped." Remember, you fear that God has already forsaken you for your past sins. But despite that, you finally relinquish yourself to your lust and commit another unpardonable sin. Tiffany and Commander Winters both realized at virtually the same time that their hands were still intertwined. They looked at each other for a moment and then, embarrassed, awkwardly separated them. Melvin Burton slipped between his players and put his arms around their shoulders. "So go on home now and think about what I've said, and come back tomorrow and really break a leg." Vernon Winters drove the Pontiac into his driveway in suburban Key West just before 11 o'clock. The house was quiet. The only lights were in the garage and the kitchen. As regular as the stars, Vernon thought. Hap to bed at 10, Betty to bed at 10:30. In his mind's eye, he saw his wife go into his son's bedroom, as she did every night, and fiddle momentarily with the sheets and coverlet.
"Did you say your prayers?"
"Yes, ma'am," Hap always answered. Then she would kiss him goodnight on the forehead, turn out his light as she left the room, and go into her bedroom. Within 10 minutes, she would have changed into her pajamas, brushed her teeth, and washed her face. She would then kneel beside her bed, her elbows on the top of the blanket and her hands clasped right in front of her face.
"Dear God,"
she would say aloud, and then she would pray until exactly 10:30, moving her lips silently with her eyes closed. 5 minutes later, she would be asleep. Vernon was aware of a vague disquiet as he walked through the living room toward the three bedrooms on the opposite side of the house from the garage. There was something stirring in him, something that he could not identify exactly, but he assumed it was associated with either the nervousness of opening night or the sudden return of Randy Hilliard to his life. He wanted to talk to someone. He stopped at Hap's bedroom first. Commander Winters walked in quietly in the dark and sat on the side of his son's bed. Hap was fast asleep, lying on his side. A tiny nightlight beside his bed illuminated his profile. "How like your mother you look," Winters thought, "and act. You two are so close. I'm almost a trespasser in my own home." He put his hand gently against Hap's cheek. The boy did not stir. "How can I make up for all the time I was gone?" Winters gently nudged his son awake. "Hap," he said softly, "it's your dad." Henry Allen Pendleton Winters rubbed his eyes and then sat up quickly in bed.
"Yes, sir," he said. "Is anything wrong? Is Mom all right?"
"No," his father answered and then left. "I mean, yes, Mom's all right. Nothing's wrong. I just wanted to talk." Hap looked at the clock beside his bed.
"Well, okay, Dad. What do you want to talk about?"
Winters was quiet for a moment. "Hap, did you ever read the copy of the script that I got for you and your mother, the one from my play?"
"No, sir, not much," Hap replied. "I'm sorry, but I just couldn't get into it. I think maybe it's above my head." He brightened. "But I'm looking forward to seeing you in it tomorrow night."
There was a long pause.
What's it about, anyway?"
Winters stood up and looked out the open window. Beyond the screen, he could hear the gentle susurration of the crickets. "It's about a man who loses his place with God because he can't or won't control his actions. It's about..." Winters turned his head around quickly and caught his son eyeing the clock. A sharp emotional pain raced through him. He waited until it had abated and then drew a breath. "Well, we can talk about it some other time, son. I just realized how late it is." He walked to the door. "Good night, Hap," he said.
"Good night, sir."
Vernon Winters walked past his wife's room to the third bedroom at the end of the hall. He undressed slowly, now even more aware than before of an unfulfilled longing. He thought for a fleeting second about waking Betty up to talk and maybe... But he knew better. "That's not her style," he said to himself. "Never was. Even before when we slept together. And after Libya and the dreams and tears at night, who could blame her for wanting her own bedroom?" He slipped into his bed in his undershorts. The soothing melody of the crickets enveloped him. And besides, she has her God, and I have my despair. There is nothing left between us except Hap. We couple as strangers, both fearing any discovery. 10. The communication room will close in 5 minutes. The communication room will close in 5 minutes. The disembodied, recorded voice sounded tired. Carol Dawson was weary herself. She was talking to Dale Michaels on the video phone. Photographs were strewn all over the desk underneath the screen and the video camera.
All right, Carol was saying. I guess I agree with you. The only possible way for me to decipher this puzzle is to bring all the photos and the telescope recording unit back to Miami.
She sighed and then yawned.
I'll come up there the first thing in the morning on the flight that arrives at 7:30 so that IPL can get an early shot at the recorded data. But remember, I must be back here in time to pick up the Golden Trident at 4. Can the lab process all the data in a couple of hours?
That's not the hard part. Trying to analyze the data and piece together a coherent story in an hour or two will be the tough job. Dr. Dale was sitting on the couch in the living room of his spacious condominium in Key Biscayne. In front of him, on the coffee table, was a magnificent jade chessboard with green and white squares. 6 carved chess pieces were still on the board, the 2 opposing queens and 4 pawns, 2 from each side. Dale Michaels paused and looked meaningfully at the camera.
I know how important this is to you. I've canceled my 11 o'clock meeting so I can help you.
Thanks, Carol said automatically. She felt a trickle of irritation. Why is it, she thought, while Dale talked about one of his new projects at MOI, that men always demand gratitude for every little sacrifice? If a woman changes her schedule to accommodate a man, it's expected. But if a man revises his precious schedule, it's a big fucking deal.
Dale droned on. Now he was enthusiastically telling her about a new institute effort to survey the underwater volcanoes around Papua New Guinea.
Phew!
Carol smiled to herself when she realized that Dale's self-centered focus was bothering her.
I must really be beat. I believe I'm on the verge of being bitchy. Hey! Carol interrupted him.
She stood up and started to pick up the scattered photographs.
Sorry to bring a halt to this party, but they're closing the room and I'm exhausted. I'll see you in the morning.
Aren't you going to make a move? Dale replied, pointing at the chessboard.
No, I'm not, Carol said, showing just a trace of anger. And I may not ever. Any reasonable player would have accepted the draw that I offered you last weekend and gone on to more important things. Your damn ego just can't deal with the idea that 1 game out of 5 I can battle you to a tie.
People have been known to make mistakes in the end game, Dale answered, avoiding altogether the emotional content in her remark. But I know you're tired. I'll meet you at the airport and take you to breakfast.
Okay, good night.
Carol hung up the video phone a little brusquely and packed all the photographs in her briefcase. As soon as she had left the marina, she had taken her camera and film straight to the dark room at the Key West Independent, where she had spent an hour developing and studying the prints. The results were intriguing, particularly a couple of the blow-ups. In one of them, she could clearly see 4 separate tracks converging to a spot just under the fissure. In another photo, the bodies of the 3 whales were caught in a pose that looked as if they were in the middle of a deep conversation. Carol walked through the spacious lobby in the Marriott Hotel. The piano bar was almost deserted. The lithe black pianist was playing an old Karen Carpenter song, Goodbye to Love. A handsome man in his late 30s or early 40s was kissing a flashy young blonde in a nook off to the right. Carol bridled. The bimbo must be all of 23, she said to herself. Probably his secretary or something equally important. As she wound her way down the long corridor toward her room, Carol thought about her conversation with Dale. He had told her that the Navy had small robot vehicles, some of them derived from original MOI designs, that could easily have made the tracks. So it was virtually certain that the Russians had similar vehicles. He had dismissed the whale's behavior as irrelevant, but had thought that her failure to find out if anything else was under the overhang had been a serious mistake. Of course, Carol had realized when he had said it. I should have spent another minute looking. Nuts. I hope I didn't blow it. In her mind's eye, she then had carefully revisited the entire scenario at the overhang to see if there were any clues that something else may have been hidden there. The biggest surprise in the discussion with Dale had come when Carol, in passing, had praised the way the new alarm algorithm had worked. Dale suddenly had become very interested.
So the alert code definitely read 101? He had said.
Yes, she had answered. That's why I wasn't that astonished when we found the object.
No way, he had said emphatically. The Trident could not have caused the alert code. Even if it was at the edge of the field of view of the telescope, and that seems unlikely given how far you followed the trench, it's too small to trigger the foreign object alarm. And how could it have been seen under the overhang anyway?
Dale had paused for a few seconds.
You didn't look at any of the infrared images in real time, did you? Well, we can process them tomorrow and see if we can figure out what triggered the alarm.
Carol felt strangely defeated as she opened the door to her motel room. It's just fatigue, she said to herself, not wanting to admit that her conversation with Dale had made her feel inadequate. She put her briefcase on a chair and walked wearily to the bathroom to wash her face. 2 minutes later, she was asleep on the bed in her underclothes. Her slacks, blouse, shoes, and socks were all stacked together in a corner. She is a little girl again in her dream, wearing the blue and yellow striped dress that her parents gave her for her 7th birthday. Carol is walking around with her father in the Northridge Mall on a busy Saturday morning. They pass a large candy store. She lets go of his hand and runs into the store and stares through the glass case at all the chocolates. Carol points at some milk chocolate turtles when the big man behind the display case asks her what she wants. In the dream, Carol cannot reach the counter and doesn't have any money. Where is your mother, little girl? The candy store man asks. Carol shakes her head, and the man repeats the question. She stands on her tiptoes and tells the man in a confidential whisper that her mother drinks too much, but that her father always buys her candy. The man smiles, but he still won't give her the chocolates. And where is your father, little girl? The candy store man now asks. In the case, Carol can see the reflection of a kindly smiling man standing behind her, framed between two piles of chocolates. She wheels around, expecting to see her father. But the man behind her is not her father. This man's face is grotesque, disfigured. Frightened, she turns back around to the chocolates. The man in the store is now taking the candy away. It is closing time. Carol starts to cry. Where is your father, little girl? Where is your father? The little girl in the dream is sobbing. She is surrounded by big people, all of them asking questions. She puts her hands over her ears. He's gone, Carol finally shouts. He's gone. He left us and went away, and now I'm all alone. Cycle 447. 1. Against the deep black background of scattered stars, the filaments of the Milky Way galaxy seem like thin wisps of light added by a master artist. Here at the far edge of the outer shell, near the beginning of what the colonists call the gap, there is no suggestion of the teeming activity of the colony some 24 light millicycles away. An awesome, unbroken quiet is the background for the breathtaking beauty of a black sky studded with twinkling stars. Suddenly, out of the void comes a small interstellar messenger robot. It seeks and finally finds a dark spherical satellite about 3 miles in diameter that is easily overlooked in the great panorama of the celestial sky. Time passes. A close-up reveals activity on the satellite. Soft artificial lights now illuminate portions of the surface. Automated vehicles are working on the periphery of the object, apparently changing its shape. External structures are dismantled and taken off to a temporary storage area in the distance. At length, the original satellite disappears altogether.
and what is left are two long parallel rails of metal alloy, built in sections of about 200 yards apiece from the spare parts of the now vanished satellite. Each rail is 10 yards across and separated from its matched partner by about 100 yards. Regular sorties to the storage area continue until the useful supplies of material are depleted and the tracks extend for a distance of almost 10 miles. Then activity stops. The rails from nowhere to nowhere in space stand as mute reminders of some major engineering activity suddenly abandoned. Or was it? From just below a prominent binary pair, the two brightest lights in the eastern sky, a speck emerges. The speck grows until it dominates the eastern quadrant of the sky. 16 great interstellar cargo ships with bright flashing red lights lead a procession of robot vehicles into the region. The ghostly rails to nowhere are surrounded by the new arrivals. The first cargo ship opens, and 8 small shuttles emerge, each one moving back down the line toward another of the great cargo containers. The shuttles wait silently outside the huge ships, while the entourage completes its arrival. The final vehicle to arrive is a tiny space tug, pulling a long, slender object that looks like 2 folded Japanese fans joined together end to end. It is encased in a transparent and protective sheath of very thin material. 8 small, darting vehicles dance like hummingbirds along its entire length, as if they were somehow guiding it, guarding it, and checking out its health all at the same time. The large cargo ships, shaped like ancient blimps, now open and reveal their contents. Most of them are carrying rail sections stacked in enormous piles. The small shuttles unload the sections, leaving them stacked, and set them in groups stretching for miles in both directions from the existing rails. When the rail sections are almost all unloaded, 4 of the shuttles approach the side of one of the remaining giant cargo ships and wait for the bay doors to swing open. From the inside of this cargo ship come 8 machines that attack each of the 4 shuttles in pairs, breaking them carefully into pieces and taking the parts back into the dark of the cargo bay. A few moments later, an elongated complex of articulating machinery emerges from this great ship. Once released from the confines of the cargo carrier, it stretches itself into a long bench reaching almost a mile in length. Every 100 yards or so along the central platform of this bench, a smaller set of coordinated components form into highly organized local groups. This is the automated multi-purpose construction system, one of the technological treasures of the colonists. The entire system moves into place at the end of the tracks, and its many remote manipulators begin to pull rail sections from the various stacks. Its sophisticated local hands and fingers deftly put the new sections in place and attach them with atomic welds. The speed is astonishing. An entire mile of new track is finished within minutes, and the great builder moves to another group of rail section piles. The completed tracks extend for almost 100 miles in space. Having finished with one task, the construction system undergoes its next metamorphosis. Tearing itself into pieces, starting from the 2 ends of the long bench, the monolithic structure disappears and is reorganized into thousands of separate but similar components. These little ant-like contraptions attach themselves in groups to individual rail sections. They measure carefully all the dimensions and check all the welds between adjacent sections. Then, as if on cue, the rails on the 4 ends of the track segments begin to bend and elevate, lifted by the ant-like components. The rails twist upward, upward, bringing the rest of the track with them. The 2 long parallel lines are eventually transformed into a giant double hoop, over 10 miles in radius, that looks like an amusement park Ferris wheel suspended in space. With the completion of the double hoop, the construction system again reconfigures itself. Some of the new elements of the system pick up the long, slender object shaped like end-to-end Japanese fans. They erect it near the hoop. It is, not surprisingly, almost the exact length as the diameter of the hoops.
under the careful surveillance of its hummingbird protectors. Then the object is hoisted into place as a north-south spoke in the double hoop structure. Some of the hummingbirds produce unseen thin cables and anchor the spoke to the hoop structure at both ends. The rest of the tiny mechanical speedsters create a web that winds around the center section and connects the great antenna with the east-west axis of the hoops. The antenna, now connected to its supporting structure, opens slowly at both the north and south pole positions on the hoop. Closer inspection reveals that the hummingbirds are actually pulling the delicate individual folds apart. The folds spread out until the entire interior of the hoops is covered with a mixture of mesh, ribbing, and amazingly complex local arrays. The initial deployment is complete. The communication complex next goes through an elaborate self-test while its construction minions stand by in case any problems are encountered. The tests are successful, and the station is declared operational. Within hours, the phalanx of robot emissaries from the inhabited universe picks up all the stray metal lying around and packs it into one of the large cargo ships. Then, as swiftly as they came, the robot vehicles disappear into the blackness around the station, leaving the imposing hoop structure alone as a reminder of the presence of intelligence in the universe. Around the vast outer shell, whose 256 sections each contain more volume than the colony, over 1,000 similar upgrades have been made during cycle 446 in an attempt to extend advanced communications capabilities to new locales. This is the last upgrade of a very difficult group in a region near the gap. This group was delayed several times because of an unacceptably high number of manufacturing deficiencies at the nearest major factory over 2 light millicycles away. After several attempts to diagnose and repair the problems, eventually the plant had to be closed and virtually rebuilt from scratch. The total delay to the completion of the project was 14 millicycles, just about what the Council of Engineers had predicted in their worst-case analysis that accompanied the Cycle 446 proclamation. As the big moment approaches, all normal activity in the heart of the colony ceases. In the last nanocycle, there is no business activity, no entertainment. The spaceports are even empty. At precisely 446.9, after 200 millicycles of debate and discussion by the Council of Leaders, the governmental blueprint for the next era will be delivered, and all intelligence in the colony will be listening. The giant transmitter is activated on schedule, and the cycle 447 proclamation pours out at an information rate of 100 trillion bits of information per picocycle. The actual data rate from the powerful source is much higher, but the information rate is reduced to accommodate requirements for both sophisticated encoding and error checks internal to the data. With the coding, only colony receivers equipped with special decryption algorithms can unscramble the message at any level. And the internal consistency checks on each packet of data in the transmission reduce the probability of receiving an erroneous piece of information, even at an enormous distance, to practically zero. Following the organization and agenda for the proclamation established in the era of genius between cycles 371 and 406, the first microcycle of the transmission is a complete summary of the entire plan. 200 nanocycles of this summary are devoted to each of the 5 divisions governed by the Council of Leaders: Administration, Information, Communication, Transportation, and Exploration. After a planned break of 400 nanocycles to allow receiver adjustments along the path of the signal, the transmission of the actual cycle 447 proclamation begins. On and on it goes. It does not stop until 20 microcycles later. 4 complete microcycles are used for in-depth explanations of the major projects to be undertaken in each of the 5 disciplines. Of particular interest to the Committee for the Outer Shell, the group that governs the huge concentric region defining the most distant reach where the colonists claim jurisdiction, is a plan from the Division of Exploration announcing the repatriation to the Outer Shell of almost 1 million species from Zoo System Number 3. The transmission of the proclamation, a wealth of information that can be translated into language, pictures, sounds, and other sensory impressions depending on the receiving beings and the sophistication of their decryption equipment, is the beginning of the governmental process for each cycle. Based upon the proclamation, regional bodies or administrative agencies with subordinate jurisdictions then adjust their plans for the cycle to be consistent with those announced by the Council of Leaders. This procedure is defined in detail in the Articles of Colonial Confederation. The proclamation is relayed throughout the colony and the near reaches of the inner shell by means of giant communication stations along the developed transportation routes. These stations, actually information centers that store all colony messages in their extensive libraries for as long as 100 cycles, amplify and retransmit the signal to the next station in the pattern, some 10 light microcycles away. The edge of the colony, and hence the beginning of the inner shell, was expanded by the boundary decree in the cycle 416 proclamation to include all points up to 3 light millicycles from the administrative center. Thus, by the time the proclamation reaches the Mammoth Zoo Complex, a combination of 3 stars and 19 planets, 4 of them artificial, just across the edge of the colony, the message has been relayed through 300 stations. The Committee of Zookeepers eagerly awaits the proclamation to find out the response to their recommended expansion of the zoo complex. They are surprised to find their proposal replaced by another repatriation plan. Once before, in cycle 429, they had proposed an expansion of the zoo to handle the explosion of successful progeny created by the breakthroughs in adaptive genetic engineering during cycles 426 to 428. At that time, also, their request had been denied, and the Council of Leaders had recommended repatriation to solve the population problem. During cycles 430 to 436, the population of the zoo complex was kept approximately constant by these regular transfers of common species back to their original homes. But starting with cycle 437, there was a rapid increase in interest in comparative biology. It was triggered by the discovery of a fifth class of life form called Type E by the Council of Biologists in Section 28 of the Outer Shell. Subsequent expeditions to the same area showed not only that the dominant life type throughout Sections 28 to 33 was Type E, but also that Type A was surprisingly present as well in those sections. This was the first time that natural evolution in any region had shown a predilection for any kind of life form other than the type A of the colonists and its developed hybrids. The quest to understand these unusual creatures led to the endangered species expeditions in the outer shell in cycles 440 and 441, and the creation in cycle 442 of several worlds specifically to study the new type E life forms. Many of these new species flourished in Zoo System Number 3, causing population and space problems again for the Committee of Zookeepers. The space shortage was especially severe, and it was exacerbated both by the need to segregate all the type E life forms and by their rapid reproduction. Therefore, at the beginning of the planning process for this cycle 447, the Committee of Zookeepers had proposed their small expansion of the zoo complex, suggesting not only a fourth zoo system completely dedicated to type E life forms, but also a vigorous campaign for completing the repatriation of all colony and inner shell species with aggression coefficients below 14. The Committee of Zookeepers are stunned by the scale of the outer shell repatriation plan contained in the Cycle 447 proclamation. In a lively technical discussion catalyzed by the unexpected proposal, the dangers of returning the outer shell life forms to their original planets are vigorously reasserted. The committee decides tentatively to take an unusual step. to submit a proclamation variance to the Council of Leaders. In the draft variance, the zookeepers point out that many genetic experiments have been conducted with the new type E forms, that the evolutionary possibilities for the new species are therefore uncertain, that the monitoring frequencies and test facilities in the outer shell are inadequate, and that the aggression coefficients for many of the group are not yet accurately tabulated. Before they actually submit the variants, however, the Committee of Zookeepers realizes that someone must have pointed out all these factors in the original debates. So why was the repatriation policy promulgated? Was this part of some new overarching design that downgrades the importance of zoological information altogether? Or is the policy strictly political and possibly connected with the message from Power Number 2? 2. In keeping with the laws of the colony governing the dissemination and preservation of important historical information, the official commentary of key council-level organizations accompanies the transmission of the Cycle 447 proclamation. Of particular interest to those involved in the Outer Shell Repatriation Project are the following excerpts from the report of the Council of Engineers. The earliest repatriation to the inner shell was done on almost an ad hoc basis, simply transporting the life forms en masse to their original region or another of similar environment in a nearby sector. This was accomplished by conducting a roundup of the tranquilized creatures at their zoo habitats, loading them into huge cargo vessels maintaining internal conditions equivalent to the habitat, and then dispersing them at their new home. This process worked adequately for small transfers over short distances. It was also cheap. However, it had many severe deficiencies that rendered it almost useless for sustained operations. First and foremost, the ontogenetic development of the creatures was completely interrupted by the repatriation procedure. They were frightened by their removal, disturbed by their necessarily reduced locus of movement during transit, and, once situated in their new locales, bothered by even minute differences from their earlier homes. Their memories, even if electronically cleansed, retained an intense sense of loss that undermined their adjustment. All these conditions taken together led to a marked phylogenetic increase in aggression coefficient across the board that did not significantly damp in some of the species for 10 to 15 generations. From the point of view of spacecraft design, both the size and distance of the proposed transfers precluded using mature specimens long before the biological and developmental problems were thoroughly understood. When the Cycle 432 proclamation called for increased repatriation within the colony and the inner shell, there was some panic at the Council of Engineers because it was thought that transportation vehicles on a near-planetary scale might be required. Fortunately, the Committees on Biological Engineering and Advanced Robotics proposed that future transfers be accomplished using suspended zygotes together with new versions of the superintelligent robots serving as zoo monitors. After a few early problems with the zygote technique, it was more or less perfected, at least for the types A and B life forms so prevalent in the colony. Repatriation success ratios for the last 10 cycles are very high, even for the more difficult types C and D. However, such success ratios should not be expected in the implementation of the Cycle 447 proclamation. Not only are some of the target life forms the newest and least understood in the zoo complex, but also they will be repatriated in many cases to a distant, poorly documented biological environment where monitoring is as infrequent as every 300 or 400 millicycles. Some of the more advanced type E forms have amazingly short lifespans for intelligence, as little as 5 or 6 millicycles, which means that 50 to 100 generations may elapse between progress checks. But all in all, it is a magnificent challenge for engineering. Many transfer vehicles will fly well outside the standard transportation infrastructure and therefore must be able to forage raw materials on their own. Conditions at the target worlds may have changed, so adaptability and the processing of new information will play a critical role in the design. The electronic components will have more failures due to the long flight times, meaning that extraordinary fault correction systems must be developed and tested. And from the Council of Historians, it is useful to begin our mostly negative comment on the Outer Shell repatriation plan by reminding all colonists that our council includes the longest continuously active intelligence pool of any council in the Directory. Two of our groups have direct memories of the era of genius through many generations of biological refresh. Thus, it is natural that our approach to any proposed project is to assess its merit in terms of its role in the overall evolution and/or strategy of our society. It is not our desire to dampen the youthful zeal that thrills at the acquisition of new knowledge or the prospect of great adventure. Rather, we would like to place a sense of perspective on all colony endeavors and measure the future impact of any perceived changes in basic policy. The proposed repatriation scheme is still another step in the dangerous folly of unbridled frontierism that began, in our opinion, with the boundary decree of Cycle 416. Instead of discussing the details of the proposed plan without reference to its historical context, there are excellent descriptions of the elements of the plan in the report by the Council of Engineers. Some of the significant short-term risks are listed in the report by the Council of Biologists. We wish to delineate its dangers by including it in our broad indictment of the entire genus of adventures spawned by the Boundary Decree. The justifications advanced for frontierism always sound good on the surface. Its proponents point out that societal change is produced by new information outside the ordinary sweep of events, that frontierism is essentially aimed at producing this kind of new knowledge, and that the resulting change in perspective that comes from a new view of the universe forces the proper and regular reassessment of our culture. History is usually in general agreement with the advocates of frontierism, and that is doubtless why this repatriation proposal and similar other previous exploration activities have been so enthusiastically supported. However, there are limitations to the benefits redounding from new information, especially when frontier investigations reveal knowledge that is either inimical to the fundamental structure of the society or beyond the comprehension of its most learned groups. In these cases, the diffusion through the society of the new information is unsettling instead of being enriching and uplifting, and actually undermines the security of the established institutions. A perfect example of what happens when frontierism is embraced without constraint can be seen in the events of the last 30 cycles that led to the receipt of the message from Power Number 2 in the middle of Cycle 444. The Boundary Decree initiated the process by establishing, in effect, a new jurisdictional domain for the colonists. The old central colony had no rigorous boundary. Significant development extended out to only 2 light millicycles distance from the administrative center. The outermost permanently maintained station was at that time a mere 10 light millicycles away. The decree of Cycle 416 regularized the nearby universe, creating 4 concentric worlds and expanding the central colony itself to a radius of 3 light millicycles. 3 specific shells were also created, with the outer shell defined to be the entire region between 12 and 24 light millicycles away from the administrative center. This outer shell contained 50,000 unexplored star systems in a volume 1,000 times greater than that of the old central colony. During the period between cycles 425 and 430, almost half of the major initiatives identified in the cyclical proclamations were involved, in one way or another, with the exploration of the outer shell. It should be pointed out that during those 5 cycles, there was also documented speculation that such a rapid expansion in our knowledge base might have unforeseen ramifications. But the negativists, as they were called, were drowned out by the collective fascination with the exploratory binge. Then, in Cycle 433, our new class of interstellar drones, specifically designed to study and categorize the many worlds of the outer shell, encountered a large, quiescent spacecraft of unknown origin. Careful in situ investigations were unsuccessful in their attempts to correlate the engineering components of the spaceship with any known technological base for a spacefaring species. Eschewing the caution suggested by many of the committees, the Council of Leaders had the enigmatic spaceship towed back to one of the developed cities of the inner shell. There it was placed on display and analyzed in detail. The initial conclusion of the drones was validated. The spacecraft had not come from anywhere inside the domain of the colony. The Council of Engineers concluded that the technological capability of the builders was roughly equivalent to that of the colonists in the early era of genius. But when had it been made? And where did it come from? And most importantly, who had made it? By deciding to bring the dead spaceship back to civilization, the Council of Leaders basically guaranteed that the unsettling question of its origin would remain uppermost in the minds of the colonists. This unbridled quest for any and all information again worked to destabilize the culture. The entire society was rife with rumored explanations to the unanswered and disquieting questions raised by the spaceship. The dominant opinion was that the craft had been a colonial prototype, never put into production, that had somehow been omitted from the official encyclopedia of space vehicles. This opinion was consistent with the general tendency of the colonists to believe they were innately superior to all other life forms. It might have been possible to let the doubts and fears about the unknown spacecraft diminish to nothing, but the Council of Leaders resuscitated the collective anxieties by announcing in the Cycle 434 proclamation that the largest new project of the colony would be the design and eventual deployment of a new generation of receiver arrays in the outer shell. The purpose of these arrays would be to intercept and decode any coherent radio messages that might be emanating from inside the gap. It was a clear indication that the leadership believed the silent spaceship to be of extra-colonial origin. In Cycles 435 and 436, wave after wave of disturbing information staggered the colony. First, there was the premature announcement that many extra-colonial messages had been decoded. This disclosure supported the widespread rumor of multiple powers in the galaxy, some of them far more evolved than the colony. This frightening concept lingered for half a cycle before the Council of Astronomers, responding to these proliferating half-truths, finally announced that all but a handful of the messages could be ascribed to a single power, Power Number 2, whose center of activity appeared to be about 200 light millicycles away. Shortly thereafter, their next astonishing announcement unambiguously identified Power Number 2 transmissions coming from sources as far as 150 light millicycles apart, or more than three times the diameter across the entire colony jurisdiction. Between Cycle 438 and the receipt of the message, the Council of Leaders ignored advice that the colony should carefully husband its resources while analyzing the impact of the discovery of a strange spaceship. Crash programs were instituted in advanced encryption. It is true, primarily, to allay concerns that Power Number 2 might be monitoring all our transmissions. This action was widely hailed as a step in the right direction. However, at the same time the exploration of the outer shell was intensified, leading to the identification of the new Type E life forms and the subsequent thinly disguised endangered species roundup. All suggestions to retrench and slow down the exploration program were ignored. In Cycle 442, in fact, the zoo complex created several artificial planets just for the conduct of genetic capabilities experiments with the Type E species. Then came the message from Power Number 2. So simple, so straightforward, so terrifying. It was coded in our most advanced encryption algorithm. It acknowledged our mutual awareness of one another and suggested opening up bilateral communications. Nothing else. End of message. It is not fear of hostility from power number two that motivates our objection to continued exploration in the outer shell. On the contrary, we as historians think the nascent concern about the possible aggressiveness of power number two is unfounded. Study after study has shown that there is a significant positive correlation between high aggression coefficient and inability to evolve into a society with a purview greater than a single solar system. In fact, the probability that a society as advanced as ours could have retained aggression and territoriality as constituents in their overall psychological makeup is vanishingly small. Nevertheless, such monumental events as the receipt of the message from Power Number Two call for reflection and synthesis, not additional exploratory activities. We should be using our resources to study and understand the entire range of impacts that the message will have on our society, not squandering them on bold repatriation schemes. It is a question of priorities, and once again the advocates of frontierism, exalting new information and technological development over the stability of the society, are blind to the downside risks of their endeavors. Friday. 1. Nick Williams woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning and could not go back to sleep. His mind was too active, racing over and over the events of the day before and the possible outcomes of the day ahead. The same phenomenon had occurred often when he was in high school in Virginia, and then a few times later at Harvard, usually just before big swimming meets. If he had too much excitement running through his system, his brain would not turn off enough to let him sleep. He lay in bed for almost another hour, alternately trying to coax himself back to sleep and indulging his fantasy that what he had found the day before was just the first item in a vast cache of valuable treasure. Nick loved to fantasize. It was always easy for him to see in his mind's eye all the scenes in the novels that he loved so much to read. Now for a moment, he imagined headlines in the Miami Herald announcing his discovery of a hoard of sunken gold off the coast of Key West. Around 6 o'clock, Nick gave up trying to sleep and climbed out of bed. The little exercise bag was next to the dresser. He pulled the golden trident out to look at it, as he had done 4 or 5 times the night before. What was this thing? He asked himself. It must have had some practical use, for it's too damn ugly to be ornamental. He shook his head. Amanda will know. If anyone can tell me where this thing came from, she can. Nick walked across his bedroom to the sliding glass doors and opened the curtains. It was almost sunrise. Beyond the small balcony outside, he could see the beach and the ocean. His condominium was on the 3rd floor and had an unspoiled view of the quiet surf. Above the water, a couple of brown pelicans soared in graceful formation, waiting for a chance to descend into the water and catch some unsuspecting fish swimming too close to the surface. Nick watched a couple in their 70s walking slowly along the beach. They were holding hands and talking quietly. A couple of times, the woman broke away to pick up a shell or two and put it in a small Ziploc bag. Nick turned away from the door and grabbed the jeans that he had dropped on the floor the night before. He pulled them on over his undershorts and walked into the living room, carrying the bag with the trident. He put the golden object carefully on the table where he could study it, and then went back into the open kitchen to start the coffee maker and turn on the radio. Except for the books, Nick's living room was decorated just like hundreds of Florida seaside condominiums. The couch and easy chair were comfortable and bright, cream in color, with a couple of light green ferns in the pattern for decoration. 2 small paintings of water birds standing on an empty beach adorned the otherwise empty walls. Light beige drapes that matched the carpet framed the long sliding glass doors that led to the balcony with the rattan patio furniture. It was the books that gave the apartment some individuality. Along the wall opposite the couch, between the living room and the bedroom, was the large wood bookcase. It stretched almost all the way from the sliding glass doors in front of the balcony to the bedroom door. Although the general appearance of the apartment was one of disarray, newspapers and sports magazines strewn about here and there on the coffee table, clothes and towels on the floor in the bedroom and the bathroom, dirty dishes in the sink, the dishwasher standing open half full of dishes, the bookcase area was clearly well maintained. Altogether, there must have been 400 or 500 books on the four shelves of the long bookcase, all paperbacks, virtually all novels, and all carefully filed according to category. In front of each group of books, scotch-taped to the outside of the bookshelf, was a sheet of paper identifying the category. Nick had finished a fan's notes on the boat on Thursday, and had already put it back in its proper place on the shelf, in the category of American 20th Century A to G, right next to a dozen or more books by William Faulkner. He had then selected for his bedtime reading a 19th century French novel, Madame Bovary, by Gustave Flaubert. Nick had read the book once before during his sophomore year at Harvard, and had not thought that much about it. However, he had been recently surprised to find the book on several lists of the 10 finest novels of all time, ranking right up there with such masterpieces as Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky. Perhaps I missed something the first time, he had told himself the previous night before deciding to read it again.